Okay, thank you very much for coming this evening. For those of you who were a little delayed, I'm Shiva Tambushetty, Associate Professor of Law here at the Law Department of the LSE. There's been an air of mystery about today's survey, and all will be explained perhaps if I explain who this man is. So this is Professor Christopher Robertson from the University of Arizona. He's visiting professor at the Law Department this term. Chris is one of the foremost experts on bias in legal decision making, and he's conducted a number of experimental studies on different aspects of bias in legal decision making, particularly in the intersection of law and science. So we're very lucky to have Christopher talk us through the results of the survey that you've just taken. Most of you would have discerned by now that this was to do with blinding. Was that clear or not particularly? Okay, so today's event really is about the injunction, the explicit injunction in the windsurfing test to avoid hindsight bias, to sort of make the decision about obviousness or non-obviousness without knowledge of the invention. So that's what we'll be doing over the next 75 minutes or so. Unfortunately, Sir Colin Burst could not make it this evening, but I have his comments on an earlier email, and I'm going to read them out. To introduce our very distinguished panel, we have Sir Richard Arnold. You'll all be familiar with Richard, and I'm sure. Dr. Zigan is the presiding officer of the Regional Court in Munich and head of the Patent Division. So very lucky to have them here this evening, and they're going to talk us through the results of the survey and also the input that Christopher is going to give us about bias and blinding as a corrective to bias. We also have contributions, practitioner contributions. So we have Dominic Adair from Bristol, who's going to be speaking to us about why blinding is difficult, or practicalities of blinding. And Anna Edward Stewart from Leven South Square is going to talk to us about how evidence that's not blinded, what we're calling unblinded, can be picked apart. Okay. So there are various aspects of this discussion that will animate or excite each of us differently. So most of you are practitioners in the room, but I can see a few academics. And some of us do a bit of both. So in order to give you a roadmap of what follows, I thought what I can do is to sort of pull out five themes I think are important that we keep in mind as we go through the discussion. And thankfully, they fit the what, how, why, when, and where formula. So my first concern with blinding as a corrective for hindsight bias is, what exactly is it? So we've seen some discussion in Canada, for instance, the jurisdiction that uses the same test, about whether blinding should be elevated to a legal principle, whether it becomes a test of admissibility, whether evidence, expert evidence, has been blinded or not. These cases probably are a little regressive. We've had a decision from the federal court last year that says, blinding is just a matter of probative value. It's one of the factors that you will use to weight your evidence. Who? So the test that I put up in the previous slide, windsurfing, who is it addressed to? Is it the expert or the judge? I think this question is very important, and it throws light both on blinding as well as a decision maker. So is blinding valid when you're looking at anything more than just a factual determination, when there's a complex scenario? And I think it also throws attention on who's making the decision. So if when you have a judge who you would expect to do second or third order thinking or engagement with the scenario, what happens to hindsight bias, and what happens to blinding as a corrective for hindsight bias? My third theme is about the how, the So how is blinding rendered practically? And what happens in the rendering of that process? In some of the discussions we've had between Dominic and Alan Johnson, who's contributed greatly to the expert reports that you've just read, the process seems quite complicated, and it's a complexity that could result in weighting of one side or the other, where blinding makes it easier to come up with a finding that you can point your expert towards subtly. So that comes back to the question that we try to answer today, which is not whether there is hindsight bias or whether blinding is a corrective for hindsight bias, but what we try to do with the survey is to ask and answer the question whether blinding as a fact skews litigation outcomes. Whether the fact that some evidence was blinded as to some issues or to the question makes an impact on how credible you think that evidence is. Chris will explain more about how that question relates to the whole inventive step issue. I think the practicalities are also important, particularly when it comes to dependent claims. How do you blind when it comes to dependent claims? It also occurs to me that we have a selective tolerance for hindsight bias because the secondary indicators of non-obviousness, you could argue, is tainted with hindsight bias, commercial success, or long-felt want. So moving on from the practicalities and the question of whether it might lead to an asymmetry in litigation outcomes, I'd like to ask why. Why this question? Why does it matter that we address this question? I think that the complexity and the sort of cognitive burden that's involved in going through blinding properly or adequately could become an issue for, the effectiveness of the law. So who benefits from a very complex legal situation? It's us lawyers, right? So the complexity rewards the lawyers who participate in the complexity. And I think there's a bigger question there of whether some of this complexity is unnecessary and we need to move away from it. And as a legal scholar, that interests me. My last theme is the sort of when and where, and just to give you a warning, it's a little bit of an academic question. So there are a lot of sociologists, starting from Ogburn from 1922, Merton, and more recently Mark Lemley, who made the argument that inventions are inevitable. So when the social and cultural conditions are right, when the time and place is right, inventions will happen. Now, if this is true and inventions are inevitable, then clearly non-obviousness is very much a function of time. Right? So non-obviousness is a social construct, it's artificial. And what interests me here is whether blinding then helps us or hinders us. Does it take us closer towards a socially optimal inventiveness, or does it take us away from such an ideal? Okay. So these are the what, who, how, why, when, and where of hindsight bias, blinding, and inventive step, and the purpose of patent law, if you like. I know it's not something that you engage with day to day, but I think we should keep that at the back of our mind. This is just a very brief introduction to some of the themes I hope that will come up this evening. So Chris is now going to take about 15 minutes. So let me tell you a little bit about the rest of the schedule. Chris will take about 15 minutes to talk about bias and what blinding can do as a corrective for bias. Then Dominic and Anna will speak about the pros and cons of blinding in the context of the inventive step test. And then Chris will come back for about 5 minutes to report on the results of the survey. Okay, so we'll have the results. And then we pass the floor on to Richard and Matthias to comment and respond to the issue. Although Colin is not here, I've got some comments on email, so I plan to read that out because he disagrees with Sir Richard Arnold.
Thank you, Shima. Siva. I do have a few slides here, starting with this one, which you've seen. Good evening. So I'll just spend a few minutes to sort of review this concept of hindsight bias and talk a little bit about the science that lays the foundation for why this would even be a problem, legally speaking, in this domain of intellectual property law, but also more generally. There are many other domains in the law where we ask a legal decision maker, a fact finder, a judge, or sometimes a jury, to evaluate a prior state of affairs and determine what would have been reasonable at that time, what would have been obvious, what would have been appropriate. And that shifting in mental states, that shifting in time, presents these sorts of problems. But first, I think it's useful to think conceptually or schematically about what actually is hindsight bias. And to define it, I would begin with three stages in time. We might call history, the decision, and the potential event that we're concerned with or worried about. And normally, we're sitting at a point in time thinking about the circumstances and the data we have available from the recent history. For example, in a negligence case, it might be about the occurrences of similar problems or the costs and benefits of a solution. And we think about whether a future event is likely to transpire. And we ask, how likely is that future event from that point of view? And we might say it's, say, 40% likely. But the problem of hindsight comes when we're actually later in time, say today, the point of litigation, and we're instead looking backwards to think about how likely was the event. And in that perspective, our estimation grows to much larger, say 80%, doubling in this example. So in intellectual property, the question is, well, was the invention obvious? And we're thinking about it from this current point in time after the infringement has allegedly occurred, when litigation is either boiling or is already in trial. And we think about the prior art as forming our history, the problem facing those who were of ordinary skill in the art at the time, and the invention itself is sort of the event that we're thinking about from this retrospective point of view of litigation. And so I want to frame for you for a few minutes is what evidence is there in the scientific literature to suggest that we should be worried about hindsight bias. And I will say that there is a voluminous amount of literature on this subject. It is literally overwhelming. So the most I can do is give you some examples of it and ask you to trust me as I synthesize the bottom line for you. There are over 800 published papers on this phenomenon. And we see it robust across a wide range of populations, from college students to people online, to laypersons, to experts, a wide range of fields, and not just in the legal domain in particular. But I'll highlight my examples on the legal domain, given our audience here. So this is a classic study by Kamen and Reshlinsky, where they ask people to consider whether it would have been reasonable to have some sort of foreman overseeing a bridge because there's this potential risk of flooding, and the question is whether it would be negligent to not have such a foreman. And in that condition, people randomly assigned to that what we call foresight condition, only about a quarter of respondents thought it would be negligent to not have a foreman on the bridge. But when you look, when you ask another group randomly assigned to learn that the floods actually did occur, but should they have taken precaution, the rate of people thinking it would be negligent to not take that precaution more than doubles. Most people with the virtue of hindsight think, oh yeah, you should have had a foreman on that bridge, even when instructed to think about it from that ex-ante perspective. In some of my own research, we've asked people about some police behaviors, like police searching a person's bedroom or police obtaining DNA from a coffee cup. And we asked them, would that violate that person's privacy if the police did that? And here we have large majorities of people, 84% and 59%, saying, yes, that would violate a person's expectations of privacy. They should get a warrant before doing so in the U.S. system under the Fourth Amendment. But when we randomly assigned some of the respondents to know that that search yielded evidence of a crime, the rate of people saying that it actually invaded privacy dramatically falls. People want to judge the reasonableness ex ante of making the search by ex post whether the search turns out to be fruitful, which of course is not the proper legal test for good reason. Similarly, there's been a study in the IP domain in particular. As you may know, juries in the U.S. have a much more prominent role, so we can actually do research on mock jurors to figure out how they will view these issues. And this is a paper by Gregory Mandel a few years ago, where he presented jurors with a wide range of different technical settings where there was a technical problem presented, and he asked which of these following solutions would be obvious in this context. And in foresight, where they don't know what solution was actually invented, less than half of the respondents, 42% here in one particular condition, I'm really just extracting highlights from these papers for you, but here 42% said that would have been obvious. But in a randomly assigned other condition where they're told that, in fact, that was the invention, the rate goes up to 71%. Nearly three-quarters of the respondents are saying that was an obvious invention now that we know what the invention was. And so I think this is probably the most pointed data for our talk today. But the question that should probably be coming to your mind, though, is first, how can we solve this? Would giving more elaborate legal instructions help? And at the time this paper was published, there was a lot of talk about a case in the U.S. called Graham, where Graham said you have to give a particular jury instruction to help them parse through the prior literature, and says, first determine the difference between the inventor's invention and the existing instructional material, then decide whether it seems obvious after that. So if you really focus on looking at that separation between the prior art and the invention, maybe you can evaluate it without such a problem of hindsight. Oddly, that instruction actually makes the hindsight problem a little worse. We don't understand why. But this is just one piece of another voluminous body of literature that suggests that jury instructions don't work all that well either in a wide range of domains. To show a juror evidence, for example, and tell them only use it for one purpose but not another, all of this is very perilous. But what about experts? Because we might hope that people with a PhD in a given field, or people, you know, with a title and a fancy law degree and wearing robes, perhaps they would be more immune from this hindsight bias. I'm using experts here to categorize both legal experts, i.e. judges or perhaps yourselves, and experts in their field, say a chemist. Because that same sort of training we might hope would make them immune from the problem. Here's a striking study by Ideal Drawer in Charlton, some people I've worked with, featured in my book. And they did this study with fingerprint experts, people that had decades of experience doing fingerprint examinations for real criminal cases. And you can recall how this works, right? They have a fingerprint that's on file. They have one from the suspect that they've gotten in the police station. And the experts, they took a set of experts' real decisions in a series of cases where they had said, this is not a match, these two are not the same. But then they put these same cases back in these fingerprint examiners' workflows. And in this time, they said, this is a new case. They blinded it. They didn't tell them they'd seen it before. But they did tell them that, by the way, the suspect confessed to the crime. So now they were able to pair the expert's own historical finding of no match with this new opportunity to read the case again afresh. Now, I warn you that, in fact, a lot of the times, fingerprint examiners render their decisions in this latter sort of situations. Often, fingerprint examiners work with the police in this sort of back-and-forth process, so they're not making these pristine sorts of decisions. And so in this case, where the examiner is told that the suspect confessed, not realizing they'd read the case before, many of the examiners now said match. I'm sorry, the contrast isn't very good on this projector. And in fact, in about 17% of the cases, thinking that these were real fingerprint examinations where someone could go to prison if they got the case wrong, these examiners, 17% of the time, wanted to follow the contextual information, believing the person was really guilty, and thereby changed their own view of the case. Here's a study. Again, I can give you hundreds of these, but here's one, a classic one by Hal Arks and colleagues from the 1980s. Giving 70 physicians all the same clinical scenario. And they asked the physicians, what are the likelihood you would have given to this diagnosis, this one, and this one? There are four different potential diagnoses. So they said, what percent likelihood do you think each diagnosis would have in that case? But some of the respondents were assigned, real physicians, assigned either foresight or hindsight conditions. In the hindsight conditions, they were actually told this turned out to be such and such. And we find here that when they were told, for example, that it was actually arthritis, When they went back to try to figure out what would be the most reasonable diagnosis, they nearly tripled their rate of saying, oh yes, arthritis would have been a very reasonable diagnosis when told that's what it turned out to be. It goes up for gout, and hepatitis more than doubles. And so we see even physicians falling prey to hindsight bias. Again, when told this is important to be fair to the person who originally made the diagnosis, you want to give them the benefit of the doubt and decide what would have been reasonable ex post. The physicians just couldn't ignore the fact that it turned out to be one of these other diseases. And here's a study with actual judges by Anderson and colleagues, 193 state court judges in the states, asked to determine whether an audit, this is about malpractice among financial auditors, about whether an auditor should have done a special way of accounting for the inventory that was in stock. And those that were randomly assigned to the hindsight condition were told that, in fact, the company turned out to be insolvent because there was this problem with the inventory. But you have to go back and figure out whether the auditor used reasonable practices, because he could be liable if the auditor did not. And the real judges here, again, you might be getting bored with the story, but were asked on a 10-point scale as to whether the audit was appropriate. In the foresight condition, it seemed appropriate in advance, but once they learned that the company turned out to be insolvent, oh, that auditor sure did a poor job. And so we really have trouble parsing our decision-making, and I want to just linger for a moment on the mechanism, because I think understanding why this happens mentally helps us think about the appropriate remedies. So again, I have this little schematic timeline of the history and the decision and the potential event. And in the history, you can think about different facts accumulating, like, for example, different pieces of the prior art, some of which point towards the discovery and others which point against it. And they sort of accumulate historically. And the situation will be complex, with some facts pointing towards a particular innovation, others going down dead-end paths. But once we have the event itself materialized, once we have the invention discovered, and someone's thinking about it historically now, from this later point of litigation, trying to make sense of what happened and trying to figure out, was it obvious? The problem is that the adverse facts, the ones that don't fit with the story, actually become harder to remember. And they've confirmed this in the psychological studies, that people just have trouble listing the facts that would have supported a non-invention or a finding of innocence or a finding of non-liability. They just can't find them in their mind as easily. And that's consistent with a broader psychology about the availability heuristic, that we seek to tell stories in our mind and we seek to make a coherent view of the path. And it's just more satisfying to have a story of the world where all things pointed, or most things pointed, in the direction that actually materialized. And so it makes it seem, of course, if that's the way we can remember the facts, and that's what seems salient, what seems relevant, then of course the event will seem more likely once it has materialized. Just a couple words then on cures or solutions for the hindsight bias. I've already alluded to one of these, where we try to give a judicial instruction. For example, make the decision as if you didn't know what the invention was. And I'll just give you the bottom line here from another body of research, is that we don't have very overwhelming evidence that that's promising. There are some particular studies that suggest giving an instruction can help. There are some types of instructions that seem a little better than other. But the bottom line is we just don't have strong evidence that we're able to channel our mind in these ways. And that's partly because of the fundamental way of the psychology that the mind works. A whole different body of solutions are the ones I've been working on. This is a book of mine called Blinding as a Solution to Bias, where we've edited a range of approaches to blinding. As you know, the double-blind biomedical research study is sort of the gold standard for proving whether a drug is safe and effective. And so blinding has been used for hundreds of years in different ways to avoid bias. And we're looking at modern approaches. Everything from, again, to give an example from the criminal setting, police lineups, for example. It's actually quite important that the person administering the lineup is blinded to who the suspect is, lest the administrator give cues to the witness implicitly. So there's just a wide range of the sort of science that blinding is developing. We're piloting in the fields of medical malpractice for radiology, for example, and more broadly for expert witnesses, thinking about ways to make sure the expert isn't biased by their affiliation with one side or their selection from one side. And so as we apply blinding to intellectual property, I think that's the question, is whether it's feasible to eliminate knowledge of the invention from the expert witness's mind. And that's what our colleagues will be speaking about today.
Thank you.
I'll be back in a few minutes with the results from the experiment.
Great. Thank you. So, Dominic, maybe you can go first.
Sure.
Okay, so thank you, Chris. And my name is Dominic Adair. I'm a patent litigation partner at Bristow's. And my instructions are that I should complain politely about the burden that solicitors must carry in relation to the practicalities of handling experts. I suppose I should add that these words are really spoken on behalf of our clients, because lawyers actually rather like carrying burdens, particularly if we can charge for it. So I'd like to make a short series of points outlining the difficulties and practice of handling experts in a way which is calculated to minimise the risk of hindsight bias, and I'll then hand over to Anna to deal with the benefits of avoiding hindsight. So I'm dealing with the cons. I suppose before going any further, I'd better explain what it is that I'm supposed to be complaining about. In a nutshell, it's the practice of working with potential expert witnesses in which first a discussion is had about common general knowledge, then a second discussion is had about the prior art, and thirdly a subsequent discussion about the patent in suit. This may be preceded by a separate discussion about the priority document if there is an issue relating to entitlement to priority. This sequence is designed to keep the potential expert away from the patent until opinions are taken as to the state of the art and where that might lead. Ultimately, it's hoped that this will allow the potential expert to give a better answer when it comes to the fourth question in the assessment of inventive step under the windsurfing questions, as restated by Pozzoli. So that's viewed without any knowledge of the alleged invention as claimed. Do the differences between the prior art and the inventive concept of the claim or claims in the patent in suit constitute steps which would have been obvious to the person skilled in the art, or do they require any degree of invention? Now, so far I've talked about dealings with potential experts. That's very deliberate. And that's because until the final discussion about the patent takes place, we cannot know whether the candidate we're dealing with is going to be useful to the case or not, and ultimately selected as the expert witness. There's a high likelihood, in fact, that when faced with the patent, he or she will simply say the wrong thing and have to be discarded. So, in terms of making some specific points about this, the first point I would like to mention concerns timing. Going through the prescribed sequence of discussions does take time, especially when the potential expert has to do homework prior to each discussion, reading documents, many of which can be very long and complicated and unfamiliar. Multiply this by a reasonably high double-digit number to account for each potential expert interviewed, and it's quite easy to see that the work involved to identify an expert witness is very significant. So, standing in the shoes of the parties, how is a defendant served with an infringement claim and wishing to mount a counterclaim of invalidity supposed to do this within 6 weeks? Well, of course, it's not realistic to complete the process within that time, but even just to work through enough of the process to form a well-supported view on which prior art to plead is difficult. What about the patentee's position upon starting an infringement claim? Unless infringement is clear-cut, the claimant may need to consult with an expert to decide whether or not to pursue the case. What then should be done with that expert, who has inevitably seen the patent and the alleged infringement before the pleaded prior art is identified by the defendant? The same is true if the patentee needs to conduct experiments to assess infringement, because of course the expert will be exposed to the will need to see the patent and consider the infringement issue to conduct the experiments properly. And the expert will be exposed to the patent at the outset of the process. The next point is about costs. Understandably, the hours spent by solicitors and experts going through the prescribed sequence of discussions, they really do add up. Searching for the candidate, putting in place a retainer agreement, conducting the discussions, and the candidate doing his homework all takes time. If there are lots of prior art citations, the figure could be many thousands of pounds per potential expert, and considering that the expert also charges by the hour. Only then to find that the expert holds an unhelpful view on the patent and must be abandoned. This can be significantly consuming of costs which are ultimately wasted. On a more technical point, the prescribed series of meetings as a tool for avoiding hindsight can be rendered redundant by the potential expert already being familiar with the technical advance which is the subject of the patent in suit. Examples of this include popular consumer products, such as perhaps the Nespresso machine, the dry fryer, the air fryer, and the electronic cigarette. It is almost impossible for an expert in the technical field in question not to be aware of the patented technology when it has been implemented commercially with great success. The same is also true in telecoms, where many experts sit on standard setting committees and know very well the patents concerned. Do we still need to treat those experts very carefully? Even if the potential expert does not guess the identity of the patent concerned, a related difficulty arises when you're actually sitting down with the expert in your early discussions and you're trying to frame the discussion about how to move forward from the state of the art without disclosing the problem to be solved. Inevitably, some guidance as to the motivation must be provided. However, as soon as the problem is disclosed, we begin to give the game away. Particularising the problem very precisely risks giving away the game completely. In essence, one could describe a patent-shaped hole in the prior art. Of course, sometimes the invention lies in recognising the existence of the problem itself, in which case it's virtually impossible to frame the discussion with guidance as to the shortcomings in the prior art. And finally, what should we do about new prior art? It's not uncommon for this to arise during the course of proceedings and potentially past the point at which considerable time and money has been spent in identifying the expert who's already seen the patent. Do we have to ditch the existing expert? Should a new expert be retained to deal with the new art? Or can we simply trust that the expert is able to control his or her thoughts and put the risk of hindsight to one side? The fact that we should contemplate allowing the expert some control over the thought process in relation to hindsight seems a welcome solution to the difficulties identified. We are fortunate to operate in one of the most thorough and forensically probative jurisdictions in the world. Solicitors are tasked with instructing the expert and assisting with the production of the expert report. The expert generally has a superb intellect and is capable of grasping complex ideas. Barristers can probe to make sure the hindsight danger has been appreciated by the expert, and judges can weigh the evidence accordingly if it hasn't. Secondary evidence, such as the contemporaneous reactions of those working in the relevant field at the relevant time, is available to shed light on the issue. So, aren't there already enough checks and balances in the system not to need what's inevitably an imperfect process, which can be wasteful of time and costs? Shouldn't we credit the expert with a greater appreciation of the difficulties of hindsight? And isn't it up part of our job as lawyers to educate them on this topic, to make sure they understand the danger, and to demonstrate in their evidence that their opinion has avoided it? So I hope I haven't raised too many hackles. Certainly it wasn't my intention. What I'd like to do now is hand over to Anna, who's no doubt going to very eloquently restore a sense of well-being and satisfaction with the status quo.
Thank you, Tommy. Thanks, Dom. So Dom has given some insights on the problems that blinding can cause, particularly in the case of clients and solicitors. And I'm going to complete the picture to a certain extent by looking at the issue from the perspective of the barristers. And before I do so, I think we need to think about what the role of an expert is in patent litigation. And the purpose of an expert, in keeping with their expert duty, is essentially to educate the court so that the court can make decisions on technical disputes. In a patent action, the expert is normally asked to address the identity of the skilled addressee, consider the common general knowledge, the prior art, and the claims of a patent in dispute. But patent law is essentially artificial,
And in having been, the expert is not actually giving their personal opinion, but they give their an opinion of what they think the skilled addressee would do at the relevant date. And in many cases, the main focus of an expert's evidence is asking the question and answering the question of whether or not a particular step would have been obvious at a particular point in time. In doing so, the expert is often asked to opine about matters that they cannot generally test, except against their own experience, and the experts often find those questions that they're asked to address artificial or even irrelevant. And what's particularly important to take into consideration is that certainly in England and Wales, experts are instructed by one of the parties to the dispute, as opposed to a court-appointed expert, as we see in some other European jurisdictions. And this has the inevitable result that one party, that each party has exclusive control over the experts that they instruct. The expert is acquainted with only with the party instructing them and typically doesn't see the views of the opposing expert until the exchange of reports. And therefore, even with the most objective and impartial experts, there is a risk that the process of preparing the expert evidence can become flawed, even if the experts themselves and those advising them haven't realised that this has happened. And there are strict rules in place to govern duties of experts and those instructing them, both to protect the expert and to assist the court, and also to ensure that the process of preparing evidence is as transparent as possible. Despite these safeguards, the inevitable outcome of the process is that although the key issue may be one on which there's a spectrum of opinions, both sides tend to ultimately end up at court with expert reports setting out diametrically opposing views on the key issues. However, the court's not obliged to follow the opinion of the expert, and what they're really interested in and is whether or not the expert's opinions stand up to scrutiny by considering the reasons that they've given for the conclusions that they've come to. And those views initially set out in the report and are then challenged and questioned in cross-examination during the course of the trial. As a barrister, therefore, my primary role in the process is essentially to persuade the court to adopt the opinions that my expert has set out in his report and to reject the opinions that are advanced by the expert on the other side. And in doing so, I'll look for ways to undermine the conclusions that the other side's expert has come to. As a matter of English law, hindsight is to be avoided when considering questions of obviousness. And therefore, cross-examination often tends to focus on finding ways in which hindsight may have crept in consciously or subconsciously into the other side's expert opinions. And therefore, if I can demonstrate that the other side's expert views are tainted by hindsight, I can submit that the judge should reject that evidence. And it's a lot easier to do that in circumstances where the expert has prepared his or her opinions on the question of obviousness with full knowledge of the target in question. But also as a barrister, we have another role, and that is that we can overview the preparation and presentation of the expert evidence in addition and support the role that the solicitors have had in this process. And we can ensure that it fairly reflects the complete opinion of the expert and the basis for the opinions that he's given. And often that's a role that you can do, that you're in a better place to do if you've been slightly detached from the process of preparing the expert report and you've become steeped in the prior art and extensive discussions with the expert in order to engage yourself with the technology. But in both roles, you have to be aware of the problem of hindsight and the need to avoid bias. And the fact is, it's inherently difficult to avoid hindsight. Once the expert knows the nature of the invention, it's very, very difficult for him or her to put it out of his mind, however much they've been instructed to do so, however clearly that role has been made clear. And accordingly, once an expert has been presented with a patent, it's very, very difficult for the expert to review the prior art or continue to review the prior art without consciously or subconsciously doing so through the prism of the patent. For this reason, a practice known as sequential unmasking was encouraged, and that process, which was first set out in Medimenian Vartis, identified an approach by which lawyers instructed the expert would ask the expert to consider first of all the prior art, priority documents, and then the patent. And this enabled the experts to form and express opinions on the prior art without knowledge of the invention, and on the priority documents without knowledge of the patent. However, it's important to note that sequential masking is not a mandatory approach. There's some cases where it may not be appropriate. In some cases, it may give a false impression of avoiding hindsight or bias, where in fact the hindsight is there because, for what, as Dom's explained, there are some industries where the technology that you're that's worth enough to be litigating is known to the experts on both sides, or if not the claim, certainly the general area of the technology and the advances. However, care still has to be taken in how the reports are prepared and presented, even where sequential masking is followed. In American Science Engineering and Rapiscan, both experts had been instructed to consider the person skilled in the art, the common general knowledge, and been presented in the documents in the order proposed in Medimune. After that, different approaches had been taken. And in the first case, the experts gave their opinions on what he thought would be obvious in the light of the prior art without having seen the patent. And in the second case, he was shown the patent and then gave his opinions on whether or not the differences between the patent and the prior art would have been obvious. Both cases, to a certain extent, both approaches were flawed and both approaches were criticised. In the first approach, if you don't have the patent at all, it's very difficult to say whether or not the differences between the patent and the prior art are differences which would have been obvious to the skilled person because the expert hasn't considered that particular issue. Secondly, if he's shown the patent, you then have the problem of bias. And so you have to make sure that you deal with each case in the way that's best for that particular case. And I think that probably the take-home message is, first of all, that it's important that cases are considered on a case-by-case basis, but perhaps most importantly of all, it's imperative that the report is prepared in a way that makes it clear exactly how the expert instructed, what opinions he's given at what point in time, and what documents he'd seen at various stages, and when he'd seen the patent, to what extent opinions that he'd previously given have been changed or modified. But at the same time, we need to remember that avoiding hindsight is not simply a question of the order in which documents are provided to the expert, but it can also impact on how those documents are to be considered. Lots of cases contain warnings about how it can be hindsight for the person to read a particular document by focusing on one passage to the exclusion of other passages, and where unhelpful passages are glossed over or ignored by an expert, that is very easy material on which a cross-examiner can start to attack the opinions that are set out in a report. Another area in which hindsight can creep in obviousness attacks is where they're based on the CG Care alone, because in this case what tends to happen is that various elements of the CGK have been cherry-picked and then put together in a pattern that may not have actually been representative of what the common general knowledge as a whole is, as opposed to various elements or parts of the common general knowledge. And that again can give rise to difficulties. And it's therefore important that even where you can't avoid hindsight, you make it very clear in preparing your expert reports that the issue of hindsight has been understood and recognised. The expert is aware of that, and the expert makes it very clear how he was instructed and the basis on which his opinions have been given, as set out in the report. And as a cross-examiner, one looks at ways of seeking to undermine that attempt and demonstrate that inevitably hindsight has crept in, and that is ultimately how you'll try and seek to undermine the opinions that expert has given and persuade the judge to come to a different view. But it's worth remembering that not all hindsight is bias, and in some aspects of patent law, hindsight is permitted. The choice of prior art, for example, is always driven by hindsight, and quite often you find pieces of prior art that would never have come to the attention to those in the relevant field, and yet that is permitted as part of Michael's sort of nodding, and yet that can...
That's because of what the law says.
Yeah, but so it's not always, and for policy reasons, that's permitted. But so there is hindsight in all aspects of patent law, and we need to remember that it's not always prohibited, but it isn't prohibited in determining whether or not something is obvious. And so if you want your expert reports to stand up to scrutiny, you need to be very clear about the way that they've been put together.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so that sets us up nicely for Chris to take over and report on the survey. So remember, the question was trying to ascertain whether a blinded report, there's a presumption of credibility when the report is the product of a blinded expert.
Okay, so this is the question, is whether blinding will make a difference in our views of the case. And this little study we did is not about hindsight bias itself. It's rather a study about one potential solution, which is blinding. And you'll notice in the questions you answered, there are three ways we tried to get at that. First, we just asked you, did you find the expert's opinion to be very credible on a 1 to 5 scale? We also then asked you, what do you think the chances are of the patent being invalidated given this expert opinion? And finally, we asked you how much would you actually demand in a settlement here? And if it's a more persuasive opinion of invalidity, then your settlement would be accordingly much lower. And so one thing we did in the study itself was blinded, of course. We didn't tell you what our purpose was. We didn't highlight, just ask you how important you think blinding will be. Rather, we randomly assigned you to receive in a report of one type or the other. So you'll recall in our basic setup of the case itself, for those of you who were in the blinded condition, there was an extra paragraph here that explained that Infratech's counsel emphasizes their expert rendered his opinion without first reviewing the 789 patent. Thus, the Infratech argues the expert's opinion is not tainted by hindsight bias. Counsel suggests the finding of obvious will be particularly impactful on a future trial court, making it more likely that they'll be invalidated. The expert report similarly, I'm going fast because you really want to hear from the judges, the expert report similarly explained how this blinding worked. He wrote some of the report without looking at the patent and then later only added in specific references to the patent later on. So the big question then is what did we get? And I'll warn you here, our samples are smaller than necessary to make good statistical conclusions. I've checked, but it really won't matter all that much because the directions are exactly in the opposite way we would expect. When asking you if the expert is very credible, in the blinded condition, it appears he's actually slightly less credible, but not at traditional levels of statistical significance. We might replicate this with another group of poor IP litigators in the future. Don't tell them, please. Similarly, we asked, what's the likelihood your patent will be invalidated? It does trend slightly higher in this direction, but again, I'm not even writing a p-value on that. And then, what about the cost to license? It actually goes in the wrong direction again here. The blinded expert does actually hammer away a little bit on the value. That is the direction you would expect if the blinded expert was more persuasive, but not statistically significant at these levels. I do have some hypotheses as to why that is. We did ask a question of, do you think the expert was unaware of the patent claims? It turns out that even in the blinded condition, only about a third of you thought he was, in fact, unaware of the patent claims when he rendered his opinion. That'd be interesting to discuss as to why, but that sure would explain why we're not getting huge effects here. And similarly, we asked whether the expert was subject to hindsight bias. For those in the unblinded condition, you actually were less worried about hindsight bias than those in the blinded condition. And I think that may be because our manipulation raised the issue of hindsight bias, but maybe you're not confident that blinding actually solves it. We can talk more towards the end. Last, just to facilitate further discussion, we had this question about, was it practical, is it valuable? the modal response is that it would be valuable, but it's impractical. And you can see the other responses as well. Okay,
brilliant. So unexpected, but interesting nonetheless. So without much ado, I'm going to pass you over, perhaps. Yeah, Richard.
Okay, so a lot of what I've got to say has been anticipated already, in particular by Anna. But the first thing I want to start with is just to reinforce what Christopher told you earlier, which is that hindsight bias is a very well-studied condition. It is completely pervasive. And two points in particular are worth noticing. The literature is absolutely conclusive that experts are no better at avoiding hindsight than lay people are, in whatever scenario you ask them. Indeed, I've seen at least one study that suggests that experts can be worse when it comes to hindsight bias. Moreover, the literature is absolutely emphatic that telling people to avoid hindsight bias doesn't work. So simply telling them that there's a problem and to avoid it does not achieve the desired result. Now, as Christopher Rees was explaining to you, he's done a lot of work on this, and different approaches can be taken in different scenarios. So one that he's worked with quite a lot in his academic work is blinding in the sense of blind selection of experts. So what you do in this approach is that experts are selected and the expert does not know for whom they are giving the opinion. So in our scenario, the expert would not know when being instructed whether they were being instructed on behalf of patentee or infringer. And there are ways in which you can achieve that. Obviously, it has complexity and cost associated with it. But of course, as you will appreciate, if you do that, you eliminate a lot of the other cognitive biases that are involved in this process, the selection, affiliation, compensation biases. But that procedure in itself does nothing to avoid hindsight bias. Hence the move to what E.T.L. Draw calls linear sequential unmasking. And this is the procedure whereby you expose the target person, be it an expert witness or whoever else it may be, to information in stages. And you lock in their reactions at each stage before you go on to the next stage where you reveal more information to them. And there is a fair amount of literature to show that linear sequential unmasking can be helpful in combating hindsight bias. It's not a panacea, but it can be helpful in some circumstances. Now, that then takes us to MedImmune. And the first thing to remember is that although I wrote the judgment in that case, the experts have had, of course, already been instructed by the time I came to write the judgment. And it was the initiative of the solicitors of one party in that case to adopt the linear sequential unmasking approach. And all I did was to comment in my judgment that it seemed to me like a good idea. And that given it was a good idea, it was a shame that they hadn't drafted the expert report in accordance with the way in which they'd actually instructed the procedure. And so therefore, having had this great idea as to how they would instruct the expert, they didn't reap full benefit of it. Now, this has subsequently come up in a series of subsequent cases, as many of you will be aware. And as you will also be aware, I hope, I have made it clear that I'm not in any sense saying that this approach is essential. Indeed, as has rightly been said already this evening, there are plenty of circumstances where it's actually impossible for one reason or another. However, the question I would come back to is this. If we are serious in this country about placing weight upon expert evidence, then surely what we want to achieve is to have the best quality of expert evidence. If we know that hindsight bias is a pervasive problem, and surely we do know that, then it behoves us to think about ways in which we can try and ameliorate that problem. And given that there is good support in psychological literature for the approach of linear sequential and unmasking, I think it's worth us considering it. Now, it is perfectly correct to say that it is potentially a more costly approach, and that it has problems associated with it. Nevertheless, I would argue that there are cases in which it can be adopted and cases in which it will be beneficial. Of course, as Matthias Ziegand will tell you in a moment, there is a yet further alternative, which is a lot cheaper altogether, which is not to have experts at all. However, that's not the way in which we've traditionally conducted patent litigation in this country. Traditionally, we have relied on expert evidence, and as I say, why not make it of the best possible quality? Now, the next point to make is, of course, I'm not overlooking the fact that judges are not immune from hindsight bias either. On the contrary, there's plenty of literature on judges, not just the one that Christopher shows you, that establishes very firmly that judges are just as much victims of hindsight bias as anybody else. Or we can do our best to avoid it, but as I've already told you, instructions to avoid it don't help. And I think that's another reason why I take the view that actually if you put before the court evidence which will help avoiding hindsight bias, that can help the judge to avoid hindsight bias. The only other solution I have is for all concerned to acknowledge what is actually pretty self-evident, namely that hindsight bias has an asymmetric effect. Namely, it tends to favour the party arguing for obviousness. We all know that. I think all we can therefore do at the end of the day is to rely upon that as a way of trying to de-bias ourselves, is by simply constantly remembering that hindsight will favour obviousness, and therefore we need, if anything, to lean the other way. The final point to make is the one that Anna touched on at the end, which is that, of course, from the perspective of the law, patent law is rooted in a hindsight approach when it comes to the assessment of inventive step, precisely for the reason that Anna gave, namely that it is not only legally permitted, but is actually routine for prior art to be selected with 100% hindsight. And the policy of the law is that there's nothing wrong with that. On the contrary, that's a rational way in which the law approaches this problem. But I don't think the fact that it's inherent in our law means that when we are looking at evidence, we should throw up our hands and say, well, therefore, hindsight is both unavoidable and we should do nothing about it.
Thank you. I think that perhaps I'll read Colin's comments, because they address what you raised quite directly. So this is from an email. There has been... I think I'll be okay. There has become a vogue for asserting it in advocacy in patent cases, and it is a topic on which I have quite strong views and about which I think Richard and I disagree. I think the concept is fundamentally flawed in principle, has serious practical objections and serious negative logical consequences. One flaw in principle is that blinding is a technique used to make a test fair, such as in medical research. But calling an expert witness in obviousness is not in any sense a test, and the court is not or should not be using an expert's view as if it is the outcome of an experiment to find out whether something is or is not obvious. The expert's primary role is to educate the court into matters like common general knowledge so that a normative legal standard can be applied. That does not need blinding. The tension is between the need to give reasons for an answer as opposed to black box, jury-type legal decision-making. Blinding an expert is like treating them as a jury. It elevates the fact of an answer over the ability to interrogate the reasons for it. Conversely, a practical objection is that blinding is not really blinding at all. As medical research shows, if blinding has value, you actually need to double blind so that people running the test are blinded too. Otherwise, they introduce serious bias. So if this has a true value, the legal teams would have to be blinded as well. My own experience of instructing experts is that there is a value in the expert believing that they reached an opinion without their being led to it. And that is so even when they have in fact been led to it without being aware of it. The lawyers can do this without the expert realizing it. Lawyers can do it deliberately and also unwittingly. In terms of legal consequences, where does it end? To guard against unconscious bias arising from the manner in which the supposedly blinded experts are instructed, should the whole process of interaction between a party and an expert be recorded, videoed, and disclosed? What a mess. Also, it would mean that in many cases, the court will not be able to receive evidence from the most highly qualified experts because their knowledge of the field means that they could not be blinded at all. If an expert's view is akin to the outcome of a test, then why do we only allow one expert each? If its probative values as a data point of that kind, then more results ought to be better. If blinding has such a value, why does it not apply to judges deciding the case? Do we give the judge the prior art first, then ask them what they think? If the objection to that is the judge is not the person skilled in the art, then that also applies to most experts, albeit in a different way. The best experts are usually much more skilled than the person skilled in the art. So in order to assess the value of their blinded opinion, do we then have to work out how much more skilled that person skilled in the art than the person skilled in the art they are and apply that factor to the opinion? Nevertheless, I will try my best to keep an open mind. So that was very helpful. So perhaps Judge Zeman can now comment from his perspective on what you make of the mess. Or maybe it's not. So
this is a very tricky situation at the moment because I want to applaud to both opinions to some extent. And what came into my mind just right now was Shakespeare, Macbeth. As fair and foul a day I have not seen. So I see the evidence of how we are hindsight blinded or bias, and this could be avoided, or at least the outcome if blinded is different from the outcome if not blinded. One question was not answered, that is there in within the blinded group, are there different answers to the same question? And within the non-blinded group, and why are these different? So, for example, if you put 10 judges into one room and present them as prior art, you have 11, 12, or 15 different opinions, depending on the time you ask them, whether or not this is obvious. Another thing which came to my mind is that the whole discussion at the moment is very much England and Wales driven, from the English and Wales rules of procedure as you know it, that you have an expert for the plaintiff and an expert for the defendant, and they crush in front of the judge. And if some of the experts go down, the other one wins, and so on. And I did not have the privilege to attend one of these events yet. So in continental Europe and also in the future UPC system, this will be totally different, as we only have court experts, court appointed experts, and what they do or not do is totally under the control of the presiding judge. Of course, parties are invited to ask questions. If they're admissible, the expert will answer them. But in the end, the judge has the control of what is going on. If you want to blind the expert as to who is hiring him, this is not possible because that's the court. You can't blind the expert as to the parties of the dispute, as the parties have the constitutional right to ask to recuse the expert because he's not impartial. So everybody has to know what's all about. Yeah? So the only thing in the German view what is left to do, because of the evidence we have, is not to provide the expert with the patent we're talking about, but only with the problem and the prior art. So this would be an approach. And I think Colin said this is not practical, and you also said this is not practical. Because you may be, you want to spare money and want to have the same expert for the infringement questions as well. How do we do that? Do we first ask about obviousness? And if this is done, you ask about infringement. But problem in Germany is that we all have a bifurcated system. So it's not the same proceeding. So, the proceeding regarding nullity, where obviousness is one of the issues to talk about, will be conducted, I think, at the appeal level of the infringement action, because they are so slow in Germany. So this is very complicated, but I think the problems could be solved. But to solve these problems, the law has to be amended first, to some extent. But my main point I wanted to make this evening is to think about if we really need an expert to determine obviousness. And if so, in which cases do we need that? Obviousness is a matter of law to be answered by lawyers, by judges. And as Richard pointed out, the law itself is kind of hindsighted. As the law says, an invention shall be considered as involving an inventive step if, having regard to the state of the art, it is not obvious to a person skilled in the art. And from the German point of view, the person skilled in the art is no real person, but is a fictitious person. It's just a concept, a legal concept. And you just need this legal concept to kind of change the glasses of the judge, put away the reading glasses and put on the technical glasses. Technical glasses meaning this is the general knowledge and the methodology of a person at the priority date, how he approached problems and how he understood what was going on at that moment in this technical field. And in addition to that, of course, the expert has the task to educate the judge if it's too complicated for the judge. If this is so, if the only thing the expert could contribute to the proceedings is methodology, what is in the books, or to explain it to the judge, all this could be done otherwise as well. If attorneys for plaintiff and defendant educate the judge themselves. And if it's about facts, which is are in the books, how could there be a dispute about these facts, which are in the books presented to students in university? So rarely in German proceedings you need an expert for determining inventive step or any other issue in patent law. And in addition to that, we have the legal concept of party pleading and the distribution of the burden of pleading and proof. The more substantiated the plaintiff pleads facts, the more substantiated the defendant needs to rebut them. And only contested facts need to be proved. And you must not contest against the truth. So if plaintiff, the patent owner, brings forward a technical argument that at the time of priority, this and that was so and so, you must not contest this if it's true. Otherwise, it's fraud. So most of the time, this is not contested. And the only dispute we have is what legal consequence is to be drawn out of that fact. And All this I just tried to tell you has already been implemented in the procedures at the Federal Court of Justice when they consider validity of patent. So if it's a complicated case, they hire an expert, they ask him to submit a written expert report, asking questions like, if you read the patent and the prior art, was it obvious? They know that this is the wrong question. And they know that what he answers is totally rubbish. The only reason why they do that is to force the expert to read all this stuff. That he is prepared when he is questioned by the judges in the oral hearing. And then they ask the real questions. What was the methodology? Did you have any concepts? What is working, what is not working? Please explain. And I think, like Colin said, the answer of the expert why he thinks that is the most valuable answer of all this. And maybe that's a way to do it. And maybe one could grasp the idea to blind somebody, maybe the other members of the panel. So if you have three judges, you have the presiding judge, the judge rapporteur, and the sleeping judge. Why not blind the sleeping judge? Present him with some information at one stage and some more information at a later stage and see what happens. So this could be maybe a way to implement the findings.
Well, thank you for that. Very, very thoughtful comments. I hope that doesn't mean you're suggesting some sort of hot tubbing of experts, you know, where you question the experts in light of the other experts. But I take your point about this seeming like a somewhat parochial issue. Do you have English law?
Can I just make one comment?
Yeah.
Which is, of course, court-appointed experts are also an answer to selection, affiliation, and compensation biases, but they're not an answer to hindsight bias.
Yes, of course, there are other kinds of biases. So that leaves us about 10 minutes or so for questions. If you can keep your questions brief, please, then we might be able to get through 3 or 4 questions from the audience. Yes.
I was just going to say they're not an answer to the expert argument of the computer. The trouble with that is that it's always at it's at the cutting edge of technology. And that's why you have a problem. Some cases like fingerprint testing, blinding the expert is obviously sensible because he's being asked, is this evidence alone evidence which supports the proposition that things match? It's therefore imperative that he does not know that there is other evidence. But in a case like the sort of thing we're talking about, it's a multifactorial, artificial exercise. And therefore best conducted in the open for the recognition that we all suffer from confirmation bias. And a recognition that we need to recognise that and deal with it, rather than try and pretend it's not there. If you blind an expert, or think you blinded him, you'll give him additional, you'll give him more credit than may be appropriate, because in fact he wasn't properly blinded. You just don't know.
So throw more sunlight on the problem. Any other questions, comments?
I just wanted to comment on Colin's idea that if the expert who has been blinded gives some answer,
yeah,
doesn't depend which answer, is this answer more correct than the answer of a non-blinded expert, or is it the result that he is too intelligent, or is it the result that he is stupid? You never know. You only know if you enter in a discussion with the expert and get an idea why he thinks that. Mm. What was the thinking before he answered?
May I comment on
one
more piece of data we had?
Please,
you'll recall the question I asked, we asked in the survey, in deciding technical or scientific questions, do you believe judges typically decide on a personal understanding informed by the experts, or B, a finding that one expert has the greatest credibility and then relying on his opinion? So are we treating the expert as a sort of test and just deciding which expert to treat? And these are your responses. No one said that the almost that he decides, the judge decides completely based on his personal understanding of the science itself. No responses there. The modal respondents were down either somewhere half and half, personal understanding and expert credibility, or mostly based on picking an expert what to believe. And I think that's a function of how technical the case is and whether a judge or another sort of attorney can actually understand it on the merits. Interesting. I think this sheds light on one of these issues around. Yeah.
The audience doesn't have any experience with German judges.
No. Really not.
And
absolutely.
You think Germans would answer all personal understanding? super judges.
Well, we have two questions.
My question is for Christopher. In your presentation, all the experiments which tested hindsight bias involved giving the hindsight group a negative outcome. So, for example, on the construction site, when asked whether a foreman should be present, the hindsight group was told that an accident had happened. Has much research been done in which the hindsight group is given, if you like, a non-cautionary outcome, so they are told that no accident has happened?
Yes, the research has been done in both directions. Hindsight bias, for some reason, is worse when the outcome is negative, when it is a risk that materialized. But in principle, it goes both directions, and in fact, empirically, it does go both directions.
Great. Yeah.
I have a general observation about the common law system, both in the States and over here. And there's a bit of, both in the Graham versus John Deere and Windsurfer, there's a bit of algorithmic work. But when you get to the end, you've got the scales of justice, and you simply shove the evidence in one way or another, and there is no theory really underlying the concept of inventive step. In the EPO, they have problem and solution, and they're looking very much for new results and turning that into a technical problem. And the question I wonder is, has anybody looked into hindsight bias in the EPO? I know of no great body of dissatisfaction with EPO decisions, but I don't know that anybody's ever looked into it.
Yes, they have to be biased, hindsight biased, because their concept for the test of obviousness is to look for the closest prior art. Yeah? And that's the starting point, without further discussion. And that's the reason why the German Federal Supreme Court says this is wrong. So it passes maybe EPO, and then it's destroyed on the German level.
Yeah, and to add to that, not only do they start with the closest prior art, they then formulate the technical problem from the closest prior art.
We do the same. So we just express it.
Any questions from the back of the room? And any last comments from our panel? Okay. Well, thank you so much to our judges and Christopher, who's been working very hard while we've been talking. And thank you to all of you for putting in the time and effort and getting the survey done. You're clearly a very, very sophisticated group of lawyers, so thank you. Oh, no, no, I think Alan and John had a line to use, so sorry we can't come to you. Sorry, we can't come to you.
The problem is that it's for after the job.
Dance. You're presuming you subscribe to dance?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have darts?
Darts
I can can't be used to this all the time. I don't want to
Any decision from outside.
Dance tells you the things that turn
it's
going
to go on.
For example,
for a while, if you're, I would say
one of the things I sometimes do.
Sometimes 10 o'clock will still be going. 11 o'clock it will start.
Sometimes it can just be mitigated elsewhere. There will be decisions, and the attorneys don't tell me.
Please,
I could go and dance. I could find.